Running a call center is tough. Leading a sales team is a challenge. Luckily, your hosts know what it takes to succeed. What you can expect from your two guides? Conversations that won't be overly scripted. Definitely not salesy or boring. Just filled with as much value as possible. Each week, Jason and Oliver will bring you topics to help scale your team, increase profits, and actually feel like you are winning. So, if you are ready to up your game and become the best in the business, tune in, take notes, and be prepared to learn. And here they are with another episode of Call Center Confidence. It's Jason Cutter and Oliver Katt.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Call Center Confidence with Cutter and Katt. Today is November 24th in the U.S. It's the verge of the Thanksgiving long holiday weekend here. We've got that as a fun thing to look forward to and or to not be working, but to spending time with people or eating lots or doing lots of shopping. For the rest of the world, who knows? Business as usual, maybe. Mr. Oliver, welcome to the show, and so glad that you're here once again joining me.
Always, Mr. Cutter. I wouldn't miss it for the world. Thank you for having me. Thanksgiving tomorrow. I would say it's mainly the US, the UK, and Europe, as far as I'm concerned, don't really celebrate it. But if it's any excuse for a party, the Brits will be there. Telling you that right now. Thanksgiving weekend. I forget all about that. So I might as well shut shop this week. Yes. After the day, shut down and put my feet up for the next 2 days.
Yeah, and do some I'm sure on the where you live, there's probably go do some Black Friday shopping and stand in some lines to buy some stuff you don't need, maybe.
Yeah, that doesn't really happen in the Caribbean. if you want to go get a new pair of mask and snorkel, or if you want to go get some shirts and shorts, then maybe you're in for it. But let's just say technology down here has a very high premium attached to it.
Yes, I bet it does. So I bet Cyber Monday is probably also more of a thing for you. And then you just get to wait patiently while things get shipped to you, however long that takes.
Thank you, Amazon.
I love it. So last week, and again, anyone who tuned in knows this, I don't know why I surprised myself. I maybe that's the joys of life. I always surprise myself. I thought we were actually going to get through this list of 10 questions and our responses in one episode, and I literally don't know what I was thinking. So what we tackled last week was a concept I had where I was thinking, okay, what should sales leaders know? Leaders, executives, VPs, what should they know or be able to answer about their sales operation? And I actually found a website that had some questions on there, and kind of we've taken that as the backbone of this. We went through the first five questions last week. And just to recap, because if any of these sound interesting, make sure to go back and check out the previous episode, the previous session that we did. So the questions we tackled so far were, are my strategies aligned with top-level company objectives? Mm-hmm. How aligned are your departments? How well do you know how your salespeople are actually selling? Are there any gaps in your process or cliffs in your data? And then how clean is your data? And so those are the ones that we tackled so far. We got through that with some adventures on the side and basically giving our feedback. If you're in sales leadership, I recommend checking out the previous episode and then grabbing your notebook for this one, because in our opinion, our experience, these are the things that you should know. And unfortunately, based on what we both know and have seen, most sales leaders, business leaders, sometimes even owners, don't know the answer to these questions because they're just kind of flying blind or hoping that if they just close enough deals, that will cover up all these inefficiencies or unknowns.
You mean you can't just close your eyes and think it's going to work? Is that not
what happened? You can't always scale very well at that. And it's also sometimes, a house built on sand that, may collapse at some point.
True. Very, very, very true. So where are we going? Where's question number six taking us today?
All right. So let's jump into number six. So how can we improve our tech stack? So what kind of tools are we using? One of the biggest challenges that I see, and then I know that you're very involved on this too with your clients and companies, is there's a lot of companies that end up with a whole lot of individual solutions, kind of hobbled together this like mishmash of different solutions, different technology, which sometimes that works because it's tough to get an all-in-one. Sometimes, you know, one thing over here breaks 10 things over here and then nothing gets used. So what are you seeing as far as like how, you know, improving a tech stack, optimizing it, making it efficient in the, you know, in a sales call center space?
Okay. So look, I kind of just want to elaborate on that question a little bit more because there's two ways to answer this. And when you talk about solutions to a tech stack, are you kind of referring to solutions to improve what's there, or it's solutions to actually go out there into the first world and kind of get your first set of tech put into the call center itself? Where do you want to hit?
I think the best thing is if we look at this question from the perspective of a sales executive. So imagine a VP of sales, director of sales, running a sales operation call center. And we go to that person and say, they should be able to answer this question is, how can they improve their tech stack, right? Okay. Or how can I improve my tech stack? Or what am I doing to improve or optimize my tech stack?
So look, I think there's many ways to kind of answer this question, right? And you've got to look at the kind of tools that you're allowing, I think, the first and foremost, your team to use, what they do use and what they don't use. And also, I think, you know, I think it's also good to understand. I think some people might be thinking right now, what is a tech stack? What does that look like? because I've worked with companies out there that just have their CRM and hope for the best. You know, are you using the right tools? Are you using the right products? Are you using the right systems in place to manage your team, manage your metrics and things like all of those different really cool things that you can have in there. Now, first and foremost, don't get any technology or any systems in place that look good on the surface, give you all the bells and whistles that everybody wants to talk about, but do you know what? You're never going to use it. And if you're not going to use it, don't waste your money on it, because I guarantee there's something out there that your team are going to get benefit from. So firstly, for me, how do I improve a tech stack as an executive? First and foremost is to look at the cost, look at the budget, and look at what we're actually going to be implementing at the right level. That's kind of really where I would go. And the reason why I say that is because there are so many execs out there at the moment that speak to all of these providers, and you know they're expecting a platform to come in, you know, a couple of $100 a month, you know, something like that. It's going to be nice. It's got, oh, do you know what? We can afford that. That's great. And then all of a sudden, somebody comes in. Oh, we got 15 sales agents out there with implementation and integration. You're looking at about 30 to 45 grand. And all of a sudden, bang, you know, especially if you're in a startup, especially in you're in a new environment, that can hit you hard. I think the first and foremost is to break things down, especially if cost viability and what your return on investment is going to be. I'm actually working with a client at the minute that actually heard those numbers. And they actually pretty much had a heart attack when I told them that this was going to improve what they do. It's a client that I work with, and Jason, you know them from a sales enablement standpoint as well. And if you're watching, congratulations to one of their team who just had their baby, the little girl today. Don't know if you got the email. So congrats. Names will not be mentioned, but congratulations. What I did with that is I actually broke the cost down for the team on an hourly rate because our client is paying us hourly. And when they heard 30, 45 grand, things like that, depending on you know the different features that they wanted to actually implement into the system, we actually worked it out that their rate is X amount of dollars per hour, per head that they're providing to us. It's going to cost them 75 cents extra on their hourly rate to implement this system, which is going to give them an increase of, I think it was sales conversion of around 20 to 25%. A reduction in average handling time by about 90 seconds, which is incredible. And these are things that you want to be looking at. So going back to your question, Jason, is when you are looking to improve your tech stack, you want to be looking for things like are going to improve what your metrics are. So sales conversion is the first thing. How long you're spending on the phone. You know, because if you can reduce time on the phone, it means your team can be more productive, which means you can generate more revenue. So all of these things have a knock-on effect. Don't go out there and buy something because it looks good, it sings, it dances, and sounds incredible. Because truth be told is they are great as long as they use the right way. And secondly, when you're going out there, look at combining your systems, look at combining processes, look at combining platforms. And the reason why I say that is because some providers will work hand in hand with other partners. And usually if you have volume and license, you'll get discounts. You'll get something that's thrown in extra and things like that. But you've got to remember, and I think that the key with all of this, and it's part of the questions that you actually pulled out, Jason, is that higher performing sales teams use 3 times more sales tech than underperforming sales teams. And I saw that on the questions, and I love that because, do you know what? I think that's absolutely on the money. I couldn't agree with that. And I think that when it comes to something like that, if you've got high performers, if you've got people that are going to deliver and you can give them something to enable their sales, to enable their delivery of what they're doing, then 100% put something in. But the bottom line for me, and I'll stop rambling, is return on investment.
And I think the biggest thing when I think about that stat that was in that article that high performing teams use 3 times more tech than low performing teams is the word use, not buy, not implement, not pay for, not have on, you know, their list, but actually use. And I think that's the biggest thing, because you were talking about, you know, bringing in solutions and if you use them. I mean, I think one of the biggest things, and there's a balance, not to upset any of the partners we deal with, but I even said this on a podcast the other day, where there's a lot of really good B2B SaaS tech salespeople who will convince somebody to buy something that either won't necessarily help them or they're not necessarily going to use. And I think it's very important to make sure that if you're going to buy some new tech, that you have a plan, you also know who's going to be the champion for it and who's going to be held accountable to using it. Because what I see a lot of times is organizations, somebody makes a decision, they want this new tech. Nobody's really in charge of it. Nobody's accountable. Nobody's the one who has to answer to when it's not being used, gets put in place. People don't like change. It's not a part of the tech stack. And then it's just not effective. Or like I said, sometimes somebody has a great idea over here, this other department, they put in something or they ask for something. It breaks these other tech stack items over here. And then it makes an even bigger mess. I think that's the key. I think what you said is, the more you can consolidate, the more you can find all-in-one solutions, or sometimes improving the tech stack is also about slimming down and just getting rid of extra things that you're not using, so that it's better to use 4 things really well than having 8 things in your tech stack that aren't being used.
And that's the perfect point there, Jason. You know, recently I've witnessed somebody bring in a platform, and they've, again, we talked about this last week, was about getting people's buy-in and getting people's kind of input into what was actually going into the centers that, you know, can benefit from this. And I recently witnessed a client bring in something, didn't get the buy-in from anybody. And now the head of sites for each location are just like, nah, I'm not even going to use it. What's the point?
Yeah.
You know, even though long-term, the team are going to get something out of it. They are going to benefit from it. But because there was no buy-in, because there was no way into it, because there was no kind of filtered down from the top, no one's interested. You can sing and dance, especially as an exec that's implementing something new. But unless your team are using it, it's a write-off.
Well, and what I have seen on that side too, and this is good for people to realize, is there's the part that everything in life is sales. So if you want to bring in a new tech stack, you have to persuade everyone that they want to be on board and get their buy-in before you bring it in, just like if you were selling anything. The other part is be aware, because I've seen this, where politics, silos, all of these things where it's like us versus them. Yeah. One department wants to bring it in. The others will just vote against it or be against it on principle. You know, where it's like, well, we don't like what sales wants to do no matter what. So if they're bringing in this tech, we're just against it. Even if it could help everybody, you have to be careful about, let's say, sometimes the bridges that have been burned either by yourself or by your predecessors who, you know, have burned those bridges between sales and others.
Yeah. And no one likes to burn bridges these days, right?
No, I mean, it sticks with you a long time. And sometimes you inherit some burnt bridges and then you want to bring in some tech stack. You're hired in. You want to fix some things. I know we've both done that, I'm sure, and been involved with that as consultants and outside parties where it's like, I mean, the whole place is on fire, but the people who lit those matches aren't there anymore. And, you know, it's up to everybody to kind of put it back together.
Yeah. And do you know what? That then also begs the question is, how long can you blame your predecessor for your problems and your mistakes? So if you are listening to this and you're an executive and you're fixing problems right now, you've probably got about 3 months of blaming your predecessor and then it's all on you. Every single decision, you can't do it. I've seen people that try to blame people for 2 years. That's a little bit far out of remit. But talking of optimization, that's a good segue into our next question. And we need to talk about how we optimize this stuff and how we clean this up. So the seventh question on our journey for our sales leadership is, are we optimizing processes for the entire buyer's journey? That's a big one, because it's not just about, you know, making sure that, you know, you got all your ducks in a row from your end. Are they in the row from your customer's end? Is your customer's journey or the buying process right from end to end? Do they get kept informed of the, you know, the entire journey, the mapping process, or, you know, until their product arrives in their hand or lands in their hand or their order goes live? That's a big one, especially to get it right, especially from a new company or even a tenured company. What are your thoughts on that one?
Yeah, I think the best solution or best like concept kind of idea on this is to understand the long-term goal for everybody in the organization should be the success of the organization, which will come at the long-term success of customers, of clients, right? No matter what you're selling, even if you sell something where you talk to them once and you'll never talk to them again, if you treat them like they're going to be clients forever, or maybe you're selling for someone else as an outsourced partner and they are going to care about the long-term success, you want to build it that way. Unfortunately, going back to the silo discussion we've covered many times, a lot of, especially in the sales ops, they're thinking about their KPIs, their numbers right now in the moment. What do they have to do to win? What does success look like for them? And they're not thinking about the entire buyer journey, including the what happens before sales, like leading up to it, what that experience and journey is like. And then once they become a client, what does that look like afterwards and how successful are they? And I know we've covered that many times, but I think there's a lot of work that can be done for most organizations in understanding from sales, like how do we set this person up for success, right? Like how do we set this client up where they have the right expectations? They're going to be excited and delighted as a client, and they're going to stick long-term, which will benefit everybody.
Do you know what? I think there's so many ways to look at that. A client I'm working with at the minute is more about the customer journey than any other metric. And I love that. And I think that's really, really great because it sets the tone right. So for example, we all know, we've all worked in call centers, you know, we have metrics like, you know, average handling time, conversion rate, and all that kind of stuff. Now, don't get me wrong, the conversion rate, the sales number is there. The metric is there for that because that's how we fund everything. That's how we keep everything going. But one point on the back of this is their line was, I don't care whether you spend 2 minutes on the phone with a customer or 30 minutes with a customer. As long as you explain everything, tell them what they need to know, set their expectations so that they are happy for the entire buying journey, do what you need to do.
Got it.
And I think that's great, especially from client side. To say that, not many people will say that. You know, more people I know are like, just stick as many as you can in the funnel. You know, get 20 sales done a day. Not you know, but then like out of that 20, you might only get 4 that actually go through to the end purchase or the, you know, the full sales cycle or actually go live or whatever it is they're doing. Whereas, you know, if you spend more time on the phone, you might actually get 8 through. You've put less in the funnel, but your end to end conversion rate is a lot higher. What's the best there? I know what I'd do.
Yeah.
So there's lots of ways to look at it. But again, at the same time, you got to keep your buyer happy. I'll give you an example. There are two providers of a service here where I live, and they both offer exactly the same service. And they are the only two providers in the country that offer it. You can't go anywhere else. So prices are competitive. However, what happens is you notice people just bounce from one client to the other, one provider to the other, because all of a sudden something's annoyed them over here, so they've jumped over here. Then something's annoyed them over here and they've jumped back to over here. And the fact is, no one's ever getting it right. I actually had one thing that they needed to correct on my account last week, and I got told this one correction, due to the internal escalation processes, is going to take 4 to 6 weeks to correct on a system.
Wow.
4 to 6 weeks.
Wow.
How many people are you getting involved in something? I'm not going to explain what the issue is, but it's a, honestly, it's as simple as going into somebody's account on a CRM and going, update. That's it. From what I know of all CRMs that I've worked with globally, it's as simple as that.
Pretty
wild.
I
don't even know where to go with that.
Yeah, I mean, and when you see that a lot with companies that feel like they have a monopoly, or they feel like everyone should want what they have, and so they're willing to do that to people, or they think people will tolerate it, or the different departments have different metrics, so they're looking at retention or sales, and they're not correlating it to why do we have to do so much retention activities, or why do we have such churn, right? Maybe we could fix it. And again, that's always going to come from the top down, right? That tells me most everything I need to know about that company. In your example, their company culture, their view of customers from the top down. Like, I get it. And I think we've all experienced that. I think one of the best things and the best advice that I hear and I give to companies as well is, what is it like to be that buyer and that buyer's journey, and then as a customer and their customer journey? Mm-hmm. And I know of companies where they do that. They have their executives, they have their managers go through the process, fill out a form on the website, then get a call and, you know, act like a customer and see what that's like and experience it. And did they enjoy it? Was it pleasurable? Like, is that what they want others to go through? And I think a lot of times leaders just are so detached from it, from that frontline experience, that they're not seeing it from that side.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. All right. So look, jumping on, because we're getting through today pretty quickly. And I think we're dropping some key points here for everyone, especially if you want to hit all five questions within the hour. We're going to move on to question number 8. Now, here's the next big one, is how scalable and accurate are your sales processes and tasks? Now, you can look at this from many different ways, top level down, even down up to make sure that they're the right way. But you got to get it done right. You got to deliver what you need to deliver. So what would you suggest in this one, Jason?
I think one of the biggest things when I think about scalable and accurate, it's usually at odds with humans. And I don't, not talking about automating everything, but what I mean is that even with the best intentions, when you have people involved in a process or a task, mistakes are going to happen. Inefficiencies are going to happen. People are just people. And again, even with the right intent, I'm not talking about anyone who's doing anything malicious or devious or, you know, trying to even buck the system, but more of just like, it's just life. I mean, people aren't robots, so they're not going to get it right every time. I see a lot of sales operations where they're like, what they've done is they've hired salespeople, or they've hired people and then fired everyone who's not a salesperson, so that they can get it down to just salespeople on the floor. And then they're just trusting that those people know what to do and that they're incentivized and that they will do whatever it takes to close deals, which usually means processes and tasks are secondary. Also, there's just a general trend. You and I have talked about it many times, where people in sales don't really like systems, processes, tasks. They just want to do what they do best. And that's talk to people and close deals and then move on and you know, rinse and repeat. So for me, one of the biggest things is, if you're asking yourself, like, how scalable or accurate is my tasks, my systems, my processes, the best solution to that, or the best answer that you should have, is how much is either automated or done with technology, how much of it is systems, and then how much of it is the people needing to be involved. The more that you have to have somebody move this to over here, or input this data, or make this phone call, or fill out this form, the more chance it's just not going to happen. Just assume it's not going to be 100% accurate, right? Yeah. And one great example of this, you know, we can all relate to, if you run a call center, is the dispositions in your phone system or your CRM after phone calls take place. And generally what happens is the number one item on your drop-down list will be the number one item that's always at the top of your reports, because people just default to whatever's easiest, right? If it's left message, it'll blow you away. Like, why is so many left messages? Well, how did you have a 9-minute call that was left message? Because they're just literally using that first drop-down. And so the question is, how do you build that? What do you put in place? And again, is getting away from expecting humans to be perfect robots repeatably over and over again.
Yeah. And I think when it comes to something like that, I mean, the first thing I want to touch on is what you said about disposition codes. That is the pain that every center and site manager I've ever worked with sits in, because you know, as you say, whatever is at the top of that list, one less click to get to that point, wherever it may be, is what these guys are going to take. And it's not through laziness. It's not through, intent to misrepresent anything. It's just click down, click down. It becomes automated. Your agents become automated when it comes to filling out those forms. I remember my first contact center job that I ever did. We had to, when we closed our sales, the system at that point, which was a home built system by the company I worked for, hadn't yet built the functionality into the system to track sales retentions and things like that. So we had to complete a form at the end of it. It was just a drop down Mellon form, 10 drop downs, and that was it. Click, 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 click. And you tracked your sales that way, and then QA marked it accordingly. But again, one of the things they use today is all of the ones that defaulted at the top, if it didn't link up to any of the others, were automatically dismissed. So that kind of encouraged us to make sure that we spent more time on it. And the other thing that I want to talk about is when you talked about getting the right person in place who doesn't like these systems, who just wants to sell and just get out there, just like any other salesperson does. One of my first ever sales coaches, Nick was his name, and he worked in the call center with us. He was on the phones, but he was kind of one of the head sales reps, things like that. And he used to do sales coaching and training with us. And clearly, obviously, got some other bonus or whatever it was for doing it. But he was the guy that taught me and taught all of the guys that came through my generation that when you answer a phone to an inbound sales call, even potentially an outbound sales call, if you make it outbound, is don't use the system for guidance until the customer is talking to you. You know as well as I do, any sales call takes personality, it takes people. And what he used to do is every time his phone used to ring, he used to turn his monitor off because he didn't like computers. He just wanted to talk to the people. He just wanted to sell to them all the time. And he used to watch him, and the call would come through. He'd turn his monitor off and he'd go, good afternoon, blah, 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 blah. Speaking to Nick, how can I help? And they would come on these phones screaming or whatever it might be, because it was a retentions job. So, you got unhappy campers coming through wanting to cancel their products. And within 30 seconds, he had them eating out the palm of his hand. One of the highest retention rates I've ever seen. When the customer's like, okay, look, Nick, tell me, look, what can you do to fix my problem? He would then go, bang, screen on. All right, let me tell you exactly what we're going to do, Jason. And it was just literally a nice straight in flow, flow, flow. Thanks very much. Sale. Good night. Thanks for coming. And his conversion rate was 90s plus every day. Every day. And he smashed it. Do you know why? Because, as you said, there was no sales or processes. It was a salesman that just wanted to speak to somebody. But going back to our question, we need systems and sales processes in place for a lot of our sales guys, because you know what? Not every sales team is going to have a Nick on their team. Well, you're going to have people that need the stuff.
Yeah. Well, and this is where the scale will comes in, right? So you can be successful with the Nicks of the world with as many of the Nicks that you have, but can you fill a retention team with 50 Nicks, or how long will it take to find 50 Nicks? Like, how many will you have to hire, fire, go through to fill 50 Nicks, right? I'm not saying you don't want that. You want that, but it's not scalable. You cannot scale superstars. And then that gets into, I'm not even going to get into it, but then it gets into the personalities, the egos, the compensation plans, the drama, the all that kind of stuff that comes with people who are superstars and want to be treated as such.
Yeah.
And that's also not scalable. And then when you have someone like that, which really good at what they do, how accurate are they with the CRM, with the dialer? Because they're making it all about that person, all about their single mission of retention for sales. But then what about everything else? In my experience, most of that other stuff falls away, which is okay. And my point is, okay, so if you know that's the case, you want them to do their one thing they need, you need them to do, which is be a human talking to another human and persuading them to some course of action, right? If that's the case, what systems can you build? It's 2021. It's almost 2022. If you still require your reps to do everything manually, like, you've missed the technology that's now available that will literally guide them, fill in things, do things, connect things. And so keep them focused on what they do best. Keep them focused on what you need them to do still, which is having conversations. And then what can you over time build, put in place, scalable systems, processes, automation, just so that there's very little that they can either ignore or mess up.
Oh, 100%. Because when you can lay it out in a track for them and it just happens, then that's how you can scale. That's how you can grow. And I think that's a really great point to kind of leave that one on, because, you know, at the end of the day, if you want to scale, you've got to follow that kind of process. But what we're going to do now is, for those of you that joined us last week and saw it for the very first time, we're going to do it one more time for you again. And it's going to be new every week. We're going to change it. We're going to mix it up. But we'll be right back after this short message.
Hey, it's Jason Cutter of Cutter and Cat. We'll be right back to the podcast. But first, are you ready to help build up the confidence of your call center team so that they can scale and generate more revenue? In our experience, there are many factors that could be keeping your sales operation from achieving the success you want for them. The first step to creating call center confidence is to determine the gaps from where you are now to where you'd like to be. If you're ready to find out how we can help your sales operation, whether it's with training, systems, technology, outsourcing, or anything in between, email info@callcenterconfidence.com today, and we'll set up a free assessment call to find out how we might be able to help you. And now back to Oliver and I chatting about call centers.
Oh, look at that. Smooth transition. Love it. Smooth as a baby's bum.
Yeah. And I think, what you were talking about and what you said too, wrapping up that last one, is important. I mean, you know, with the technology piece,
and again,
I think, you know, it's really about getting the teams to understand that systems, processes, automation isn't there to replace them. It's to help them. Right.
And yeah, I think a lot of people worry when it comes to automation that they're going to lose their jobs. A friend of mine works and resells with one of the best automation bot systems in the country, in the world, should I say. And I speak to him very regularly. And his line every single time is, we are not putting bots in to replace anybody. We are there to give them more time to enable them to do stuff that they are employed to do. And the reason being is we get pulled into stuff left, right, and center. The truth be told, all of us do. Every single person that I've ever worked with in a call center does jobs that does not even fall in their remit. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I remember my last internal job that I did as director of learning development. I was in ops, I was in workforce, I was in HR, you know, all of this stuff comes into play. I mean, don't get me wrong, I work for a support function. Of course you support the rest of the business. But again, I work with call center managers that get sucked into doing training, that get sucked into doing all of this kind of stuff. And the fact is, if we had something like this to automate reporting, okay, let's take workforce very quickly for an example. I don't want to go off on a tangent, but workforce.
Yeah.
The last workforce team that I work with spent so much time building their reports to be sent out, and then management rebut them and argue this and argue that and go, oh, I don't think that's accurate. Can you go back and check it? Machine learning automates this and fixes this based on the queries, based on what you're doing, and based on how the tasks are dealt with at hand. I couldn't even say that word then. And the fact of the matter is you can put somebody in there to automate that all of a sudden that then frees up your workforce guy to then get the report in front of them and actually break down the analytics and to say, hey, this is why this is that. This is why this is that. And then send it out. because you're now giving them more tools to improve what they do. So don't ever feel that automation is going to take everybody's jobs away. It's not. It's there to work hand in hand. The same way that, again, one of our partners who we mentioned earlier on, Jason, as a prime example, their sales enablement tool, which increases conversion, does live quality assurance, isn't there to remove or replace a quality assurance team. It's there to give the QA team more information about what's happening. So instead of giving a standard coaching document back to the manager, instead of giving them basic information, you can go back in there with a completely detailed approach and they say, well, this is how you fix it. You know, a machine's never going to tell you how to fix it. Machine's going to tell you what's wrong. The human element now tells you how to fix it. And that is powerful.
Yeah, which I think goes into this next one, right? So question number 9 on this list is, what's my ratio between analysis and action? And, you know, kind of going on the back of what you were just saying, why don't you continue on this from your perspective?
Look, I don't think there's any right or wrong here in terms of time you should be spending on analysis versus doing. Don't get me wrong. Doing is always better than sitting there looking at documents and analyzing data, because you could be sat there for hours, days, weeks, months, and then come up with, okay, yeah, we're just going to change this one simple step. And you can keep going back to it time and time and time again. As long as there is output on the analysis that you are seeing an improvement on, then it makes sense. Again, jumping back to the last company I worked for directly, they had a report that came out of QA based on trends. Okay. Now you could sit there and analyze these trends that QA were picking up across 400, 500, 600 call center agents. And truth be told, if you wanted to, you could spend a week training everybody to fix one thing that's cropped up once, you know, and waste everybody's time. But, you know, in my point, you use that report, you look at the number of times it's occurred, you build your analysis very quickly, the same way that you'd use your numbers in a training needs analysis or anything like that. Find out where your actual trends are that are going to cause a monetary issue or a personnel issue, or a complaints issue, that, you know, something you're trying to avoid, and they're the ones that you fix. You know, you look at the areas where you are going to struggle the most in order to fix that area. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think there's the law of diminishing returns, right? Which is, I know, a trap that I've gotten into myself in sales leadership in the past, mm-hmm. which is, okay, just looking through the data so long and then finding this one trend that we could do this one thing to fix. But the effort and then the result is so incrementally small that it doesn't make sense. The juice is not worth the squeeze, right? And so the question always is like, what are you looking at and where's it going to move the needle? What makes the most sense? Sometimes it's not about fixing anything, but it's more, sometimes it's about doing more of what you're doing, right? Mm-hmm. So like, if things are working and things are profitable, okay, how do we get more people? How do we open up a new office, right? Versus how do we just fix what we've got, or how do I squeeze a little bit more out of everyone, a little more, you know, sales per hour as an average over the whole thing. And so that's a big difference for me. I think really when I think of this question is, what's, you know, again, the question, what's my ratio of between analysis and action? I think it depends on where you are at in the org chart. Right. So if we're talking specifically for, let's say, VP level sales revenue leaders, I think there's going to be a lot more analysis and a lot more strategy happening, because they're looking at the battlefield, right? The call center, the operation, the sales team, they're looking at that from a high level, right? You've got the CEO, the president, then you've got the any other C levels, then you got the VP. And they're flying above the battlefield at, you know, 10, 15,000 feet. They're looking at everything. As you get closer to the frontline individuals, right, the salespeople, it's going to be less analysis and more action, right?
Yeah.
That frontline manager, that team lead, that shift manager, that sales manager, whatever that looks like in your organization, they don't have time to analyze the battlefield a lot, right? What they need to do is they need to focus on how do I support the troops so that I can keep them moving along. Like, we don't have time to have lots of meetings or strategize. They need to get that strategy from above so that they know how to continue moving forward and keep everyone going. And so I think that's one of the main things, is always understanding where your level. I see a lot of people who end up in a leadership role, like sales manager role. And what happens is they end up getting stuck into a lot of meetings, a lot of strategizing, a lot of report building, and then a lot of report, you know, distributing, and I call it email hell. They get stuck in all of these things because management above them is doing that. And they think that, okay, everyone should be dealing with emails or on Slack or having meetings or doing presentations or analyzing data or, you know, running reports. And really what that's doing is it's distracting your frontline managers from what they need to be doing, which is keeping everyone going, right? If we look at the battle example, it's like they need to help win the war on the front lines. They need to keep all of their troops alive in the moment, right? And if you think about how stressful, how many challenges, how many things occur in every single day and every moment of every day for a sales team on the front lines, like, that frontline manager needs to be focused on that. And so I think with this, the question, the answer in my mind is, depending on where you're on the org chart, your ratio is going to be different. It's not like, oh, it's 90% this and 10% this. It's like, it depends on where you're at and what your job focuses on. And then obviously how it fits into the whole org.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. And I think when it comes to that ratio, I don't want to keep saying I think, because it is, it's truth. It's what we see. But we do start to see those people take a step back that do start to pass out those orders, do start to pass out, because they are the ones that kind of see it at a top level. They're looking down on the battlefield from a high level, as we, you know, so to speak. And with that, they're the ones that do give the direction, because they can or have the time to do analytics. I will say now, like, the amount of sales managers, that frontline sales managers that I see on the floor, they're looking at the reports in the morning. They're getting a overview of what happened yesterday or what's happened for the week or the month to date, and therefore they're changing their strategy as they go on the fly. And then, as you say, it's probably usually the people that are set back a little bit that actually have the ability to make those changes. That's what I see, and I agree with that. I don't disagree. I don't think there's anything different to that. But I do think people need to take advantage of making sure that they understand what their analysis is telling them and actually go and do something from it. You've got to see a change. There's no point putting something out there where they're not going to see anything out of it in the long term. That's just a waste of time.
Yeah. And I think one of the biggest things that I think is good advice for sales leaders, I think for everybody, for all of us, it's also the basis of the book that's on my bookshelf behind me, which is called The Road Less Stupid. You know, one of the fundamental things I took from that is start less things, finish more things, right? We, especially people like you and I, solopreneurs, entrepreneurs, business leaders, we want to start all kinds of things, not just chasing shiny things, but also, like, that's a good idea. We could solve that problem. We should build that, right? Like, I currently have 3 podcasts under my name that are active, and I feel like I'm not doing enough. Like, maybe I should do more. Like, it's like, you know, writing more books. But for sales leaders, I think one of the problems is you have a meeting, you analyze some data, you have a meeting, there's a bunch of action steps. Tomorrow or next week, there's another meeting with another report, more action steps, and nothing is actually getting done, and or nothing is getting letting run its course such that you can see if that fixed it, right?
Yeah.
And I think when we look at it from a scientific standpoint, you wouldn't just like, okay, let me try this. I'm going to try to make a cake. All right, let me switch this one ingredient. And before the cake's done, let me try a different cake with a different mixture and let me see if that works. And we don't even know if the first one worked yet because we haven't given it time. Or we've talked about it and we haven't tried it. So I think when it talks about this ratio between analysis and action, it's also about, like, what are you actually following through with? analyzing is good, but don't just end up with this long list of all these actions you're actually not doing or following through with or completing, because then you're just chasing all these things. A month later, 6 months later, next thing you know, you look back and it's like, well, we didn't really do anything and we're not in a better place. And we spent a lot of time in meetings.
A meeting about a meeting.
And then there's meetings that are about meetings that produce more meetings and more work.
And look, my final thought on that piece is, you know, you look at your analysis like you look at your KPIs and your metrics that you measure. Don't overthink them. Don't measure too many. So in other words, don't look at too many different stats to analyze. Focus on the small, quick wins that will turn into long-term gains, or focus on what you already know is a long-term gain and go with that. Because as Jason said, the more you kind of put under without completing something, the worse off you're going to be, and you're going to have too many unraveled lines that you don't know how to put back together.
Yep. All right. Here we are. Question number 10.
Boom.
Here we go. Here's the question. Am I using my soft skills to my advantage? So that would be the question. If I was in a upper leadership role or even as a consultant asking, let's say a VP of sales, are you using your soft skills to your advantage? Can you answer that? I think most people would just automatically say yes, but are they? Are they truly using?
The smiling, the nodding, yes, but they're actually thinking, get out of my office now, you imbecile.
I'll show you some soft skills.
Go!
Yes. I'm great with people. Get out of my office.
With a few expletives thrown in.
Probably, as long as HR is not nearby. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Look, 100% people in these positions need soft skills. I wouldn't expect a lot of people to be that high without some form of soft skill or IQ or EQ, depending on what you're looking for. But what I do think is there are some people at that level that don't have anything, that may actually be, you know, kind of on that, that narcissistic border or something, like, you know, yeah, where they don't have that because, you know what, they've worked their way up and they've done their own business and they've run a sales function their entire lives and they've got to where they are. I can sit down right now and I can name on one hand 5 sales leaders that should not be sales leaders because their personality sucks, but their numbers get results. The way they act with their team gets results. But do you know what? There is no way on this planet I would ever get on with these people. But then there are some sales leaders out there that I think are the best at what they do, and they are lovely people at the same time, but they have that balance. They have that line that when they're in the office, they are that salesperson with the sales skills, with the office skills, with the managerial skills to go out there and do that. And then all of a sudden, bang, line closed, out there, work is work, personal is personal. Look, they are an important factor in any environment. Soft skills are always top of my list. It's one of the biggest things that I train out for any salespeople and any induction. A lot of people will try and skip it over, going, oh, we don't need that nonsense. We don't need to worry about that. But that's when you start to look at things like, you know, body language, tonality, the words that we use. We break those down into facts and figures and put numbers to them. A lot of people don't realize that, in actual fact, that when we do communicate with people from a soft skill standpoint, that actually only 7% of communication is made up by words, what we actually physically say, which, as we know, can be misconstrued, misread, and misinterpreted at the drop of a hat. My question to everybody when I'm training soft skills is, how many of you have ever taken a tweet, a text, a Facebook post, a LinkedIn post, and read it the wrong way, taken it completely the wrong way and gone, why is he writing about me? It's got nothing to do with you. It's like, that's a bit rude. Because again, we're only seeing 7% of the communication. You know, body language and tonality make up the remaining 93%. It's why, you know, one of the reasons why people now use emojis and smileys and all those kind of things to kind of collaborate and tell people what they're actually saying by adding tone to it. But look, for me, difficult conversations as a sales leader are something that stand out in my forefront of my head. having those conversations, having those crucial conversations, not just as a salesperson, but as a leader as well. Some people don't know how to have them. And that's why soft skills are so important, because you have to be able to peel back all of those layers and get that message across. But again, for me, it's a big piece of any work that I do in that remit. And I think a lot of companies would quite happily skip it if they could.
Yeah. And that classic old model, like you were talking about on the narcissistic side, where you've got that salesperson who's just doing things their own way, then they get promoted and they just assume everyone's either going to fall in line or they're going to get rid of them and keep finding more people like them.
Yep.
Or people who tolerate them or fall into line behind them. You know, that doesn't work. I mean, some organizations still go that route, but it's, you know, there's a wake of destruction that happens behind that. And I think really it's, if you want to, from a business perspective, really be logical about it, the soft skills are so necessary when it comes time for change, which is a constant in sales operations, right? We're talking about technology when we started this episode. I mean, we've talked about comp plans in the past. We've talked about all kinds of things that require the team to change, right? A new script, a new process, compliance, QA, whatever that looks like. And so they've got to feel like the organization cares about them. They're a part of something bigger. And I think those soft skills matter. I also think what I see, and this is the part that a lot of leaders are missing, if they're struggling with their teams, is they just assume that everyone is like them, wants to sell like them, is motivated by the same things as they are. And it's like, well, when I was a rep, I loved bonuses on Fridays because that made me work harder. Well, maybe not everyone cares that same way, right? Or maybe people want different things or are treated differently, want to be treated differently. And I think those soft skills, whatever you can do, that's why my number one management book that I recommend across the board is The Five Love Languages. And I've mentioned it before, I think, on this show. And it's a weird thing. People are like, well, what are you talking about with love languages? Check out that book or go online and take a quiz. They also wrote us another follow-up one, which is The Five Love Languages for Business. Right? So you can tailor it to more business, because one of the love languages is touch. HR gets a little weird about that. So what do you do instead of that? Or how do you manage that? But like, that's important. And one of the biggest principles you get from that is that everyone has a different language. They want to be treated differently. And that most of us try to treat everybody the same as we see the world, right? Like if you're a gift giver, you think everyone loves gifts, but they don't. And so how do you work on those soft skills to really treat everybody different? I mean, I had a manager. He used to frustrate me and drive me crazy. He worked underneath me. He was a branch manager. He used to drive me crazy in so many ways. He didn't like change. He was a pure sales guy who became a manager. So any script changes, anything like that, sometimes he would smile to my face and say, yes, we'll definitely do this. And then he would undermine it to the team and I'd wonder why it never worked out. And then I found out, like literally after we got off the call, he would tell everyone, like, we're not doing this. This is dumb. And so like, he drove me crazy. But one of his best things that he had, being such a relational salesperson, and he cared about everyone on his team, is his soft skills were amazing. He had 40 reps in an office and he knew what motivated each one of those people. Yeah. He knew what was going on in each one of their lives every single day, who was breaking up with who had drama, who was doing well, who wanted to buy a new car, who was, you know, this and that. And literally he knew all of them.
Yeah.
And I would quiz him. I'd be like, hey, tell me about everybody. He's like, boom, boom, boom. Just go up and down the rows in his mind. And he could tell you about every single person and how they were doing in general that day. And from that standpoint, he was an amazing leader.
Could he tell the difference between when he needed to draw the line?
Here's the challenge, and I see this with a lot of sales leaders, especially if they're close to the front line. Their loyalty goes to the reps, especially if the reps are responsible for their compensation, right? As a manager, the reps' performance equals your performance and your bonus or your KPIs, or you're not getting fired. And so the problem is sometimes is the loyalty, and I had to remind him, like, your loyalty is to the company, not to the reps, right? Like, if everyone fails, like, this is not going to be good. And it's that balance between, you know, where that is. And sometimes that manager is correct. Like, we need to not change, or this is going to upset people, or, you know, let's let's do this strategically. But I do say a lot, it depends on where the loyalties lie, right? And you see that with salespeople too, is where salespeople go to their managers and be like, I need a discount. I need this for this client. Like they need this. I need a different contract. It's like their loyalty is to the deal and the client, not the company. And then they're fighting for the wrong thing.
Yeah. I mean, that's a tough issue, which is why I asked the question. Look, it's great when you have a leader with those soft skills that have a close relationship, that know everything about everybody that are involved. But knowing when not to cross that line and be the leader versus the friend, the buddy versus the boss, for me, that's a big one. There's a lot of leaders out there that don't do it, maybe because they haven't been through the right training to be able to segregate and put those boundaries in place to stop the tensions from arising. Hey, look, we talk about this. We talk about leadership all the time. And we're not necessarily talking about this today, but that's a big one on my list. You know that one.
Yeah, well, and fundamentally, we talk about the soft skills. Like you said, it's about the communication, the verbal, the nonverbal. Yeah. It's the relationship side. There is that line, so you got to keep it professional. You know, you can't do happy hour with your team if you're a leader, because then when you have to be a leader or a manager and do some tough things in business or implement some change, people might not respect you in that same way. But no matter what, you're dealing with humans. You're dealing with people. So the soft skills, really good soft skills when done right, will help facilitate the business side that needs to be done. Again, as long as you watch that line, I think it's super key. So now there's one other question. We're not going to get to it. So I'm just going to, you know, throw this out there. And this is for people to think about. We won't even necessarily address it next week, but on this list from the site, and if you want the list of these, message us, you know, wherever you're watching this, if you're watching the replay, you know, just put a comment in there, we can reply, or you can email us info@callcenterconfidence.com. Happy to send you the link for this article as well as just the list from our side. But there was a number 11 they threw in there, and I just want people to think about this and kind of chew on this, maybe even through the end of the year as you're looking at 2022, which is, what does success look like, right? What does success look like? And not just for you, not just your comp plan, not just your department, but for the company and the clients. What does that overall look like? What does success look like? Whether it's, you know, the speed at which deals are happening, like that, the days to close or time to close, the conversion, cost per acquisition, you know, what are the benchmarks, KPIs? How would it feel? How does it look? What does success mean to you or look like for you and the organization? I think that's always an important thing to be talking about. And it's going to be different for everybody, and it's going to change. And it may not be the easy number. Success looks like, you know, 500 deals a month. Does it? Like, at what cost? Right. Yeah. So you have to look at the big picture.
No, 100%. Awesome. Well, look, that brings us to the end of today. Really some great points there, Jason, answering these questions. Loved it every step of the way. And as Jason said, if you want the questions, please get in touch, info@callcenterconfidence.com. Don't forget, you can follow us on all of the social medias, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn. I'm trying to think if there's any else. YouTube pages are there. One of the things that Jason did make me aware of this week, that apparently our link on our website is broken for the previous episodes. I will fix that this week, and I will update that with all the remaining episodes. But if you do want to just listen in, don't forget, you can join us on any of the podcasts out there through Apple, Spotify, Deezer, Amazon, Stitcher. I can't. Everywhere. Well, like, we're everywhere. We are everywhere. But you can also you can get that. And also, just a new thing. Obviously, I know we mentioned it a couple of weeks ago, and it's officially live now, that we are going to be inviting all of you beautiful people onto episodes with us to either answer your questions, talk about call centers, go completely live and off the cuff and see what happens. It's going to be crazy, crazy call center confidence with Cutter and Kat. We'll just throw another C in there. And if you want to sign up, you want to be a guest on the show, then all you need to do is go to calendly.com/call center confidence. We have appointments there available for the next 6 months. So if you want to book yourselves out 6 months ahead, but you see, you know, if you're that busy, and he can only afford an hour for us in what, March of next year or whatever it is, then just go through, put it in there. We will get a notification, and in there we'll send you the links to the stream so you can join us live, and we can answer your questions live on Call Center Confidence with Cutter and Kat. There's only limited spots. So it's one person per episode. So get in there if you want to join us. But looking forward to having you on there when you can. Jason, have I missed anything else? But if I haven't, thank you very much. Appreciate you as always. Some bombs that you have dropped today. Looking forward to episode 28, which we'll announce our content for in the next coming days. But it's been a pleasure, Jason, as always. Looking forward to speaking to you all soon, and we'll see you next week. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for tuning in to this episode of the Call Center Confidence Show with Cutter and Kat. If you're enjoying the show, please feel free to rate, subscribe, and leave a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. We really appreciate that effort. For more info about the show, you can always go to www.callcenterconfidence.com. Thanks again for tuning in, and we'll catch you in the next episode.